Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our May 22nd service. Our guest speaker is Jody Bauer. Her topic is Midwifing Change. Thanks for listening.
In a moment, I'm going to be talking about different approaches to social change. For the reading, I wanted to give you an example of one method of social change. Lynn Twist is a global activist. For many years, she was involved in the Hunger Project, which has as its mission to eliminate world hunger. In the book, Twist says, "The Hunger Project draws its power for social action from the principles of personal transformation and empowering self-inquiry." And examples of questions that they ask include, "Who do I need to be to fulfill the commitment I've made? What kind of human being do I need to forge myself into to make this happen? What resources do I need to be willing to bring to bear in myself and my colleagues and in my world?" Here's an example of what happened when the Hunger Project went to Bangladesh in the 1980s, when Bangladesh was struggling to survive after seceding from Pakistan in 1971. At the time, nearly 60% of the population was living in poverty, and basically the country was subsisting on foreign aid. Twist writes, "As the first step in forging an effective partnership, together we look deeply into the Bangladeshi culture, their attitudes and beliefs about themselves, their resignation and hopelessness. It became clear that after so long subsisting on aid, the people had lost touch with any sense of their own competence or any vision of their country as capable of success. In our meetings together, the Bangladeshi leaders determined that the thing that was missing, which, if provided, would enable these people to become self-reliant and committed, or self-sufficient, was a vision of their own strengths and capabilities. The Hunger Project committed as a partner to develop a program it designed to enable the Bangladeshis to reconnect with a vision for themselves and their country, with an awareness of their available assets and strategies to put their ideas into action. Out of this commitment and partnership came the Vision, Commitment, and Action Workshop. It called upon participants to engage in a series of group discussion and visualization exercises, enabling them to imagine and envision a self-reliant, self-sufficient Bangladesh, the Bangladesh they had fought for years ago in their struggle for independence. The workshop asked questions like, what would it look like if Bangladesh was exporting its finest quality goods? What would it be like if Bangladesh was known for its art and music and poetry? What if Bangladesh was a contributing member of the global community? If Bangladeshi men and women and young people were a contribution to society, what would that look like? In the first meeting, over 1,000 people showed up, and they held it in the town square. Sitting quietly, tears streamed down the faces of many of the participants as they imagined a prosperous Bangladesh. In the next step, people talked about their visions and then came up with action strategies. You could see them drop their anxiety and fear, letting go of their sense of lack of an inadequacy, and step up to their own creation and commit to it. In that exercise, you could see people's posture and countenance change. People seemed to visibly strengthen. Their sense of resolve and determination was contagious, and the impossible seemed possible. The actions were practical, local, doable, but in alignment with their new commitments and in service of their visions. People seemed to re-see themselves, their family, their village, and their country as able, resourceful, and potent. She then tells the story of one man, Zilu, who actually was just in town for another reason and came to the workshop kind of by accident. He was so inspired by the workshop that he returned to his home village and told six friends about it. And with them, he held a similar vision workshop in his village. The participants came up with a plan to reclaim some wasteland on the edge of the village for farming. Here's what happened next, according to Twist. Those 600 people got to work, building a road along the edge of the land and starting the clearing effort. Impressed with their vision, clarity, and commitment, the government gave them 100 more acres to develop. They trained the young people who had turned to begging and crime to cultivate and farm instead. They trained destitute women, many of them widows, to farm. In clearing the land, they were surprised to uncover a previously unknown lake and a small stream abundant with fish. The entire area was now under cultivation, providing food, fish, training, and employment for hundreds of people. We walked the fields with Zilu and visited the fisheries. We were overwhelmed by the people's joy, vitality, and success. They had accomplished this feat with almost no help from outside. They had had what they needed all the time: the land, the water, the intelligence, the muscle, and the capacity to put it all together. Once they were inspired to see themselves as strong, creative, and capable, their commitment knew no limits. Success was inevitable. Good morning. I am standing here this morning as the descendant of a long line of Unitarians. My parents were married in the Old Ship Church in Hingham. Do you know about that church? It's a Unitarian church, the longest continually worshipped in church in the United States. And coming from a line of Unitarians means that I come from a line of social activists. When I was in social work school, I was delighted to find that my great-great-grandfather, Gideon Haynes, was mentioned in my textbook as one of the first prison reformers in the United States in the 1850s. This was after an acting career. My great-aunt Inez Haynes Irwin was a noted suffragette and one of the first women war correspondents. My mother campaigned for reproductive rights in the 1960s. My father is a lifelong advocate for public schools. My sister works for Child Protective Services. My niece was in the Peace Corps. All of the men in my family have served in the armed forces in some way. And I helped start the first recycling center in my hometown in 1970, and a few years later was a volunteer at a radio women's health clinic in Seattle. As an environmentalist, I'm proud of the fact that I've probably planted over 5,000 trees to help us breathe. I could go on, but the point is, this is what my family does. And most of my friends are social activists as well, which means that I have had an up-close and personal look at what happens to people when they want so very deeply to change things, and yet the problems are so big and it's so hard. I've spent the last decade writing a book about the journey of the wandering heroine, a story that has been written by countless women and quite a few men, yet has received surprisingly little attention from literary scholars. In the book, I contrast this heroine story with that of the hero, in which a young man goes out into the world and after a series of trials and tests, accomplishes what author Sherry Tepper calls the single wondrous thing. He pulls the sword from the stone, he throws the One Ring into the fire, he defeats the evil emperor. By one act, he saves or restores his community. He accomplishes this by doing. He is proactive and forceful, and he makes things happen. Yet oddly, in the end, what really happens is that he just returns the community to the status quo, to a prior state of being. In contrast, the wandering heroine doesn't usually do anything so dramatic. She's not out to save others. She's out to save herself, to find a way of being in a world that's usually telling her that she needs to be somebody different from whom she wants to be. She has to keep leaving situations where she can't be herself until she learns how to stand in her own integrity. You might think this is rather self-centered. Yet oddly, in the end, by being herself, she often sets in motion a transformation process that helps her community change what needs to be changed and move into the future. After I wrote the book, and after it came out, I began to realize that there was something I hadn't covered, which is the implications for these two different ways, doing and being, and what they might mean for how we approach problems. For the most part, I think that we do follow the hero model when we go to solve a problem, and that, I think, has some issues. So I want to deconstruct the heroic model a little bit more. And I want to note here that if I say use he for the hero and she for the heroine, I'm just following the traditional usage, but anybody can be either. So first of all, in the heroic model, there's a problem. Something is wrong. And that means usually there's a villain, which could be a person or an organization or an institution or even the whole culture that is perpetrating or perpetuating the problem. In other words, something or someone is to blame. So there's a right side and a wrong side. The hero, of course, is on the right side. The hero fixes the problem by conquering or defeating those that are in the wrong, those that are to blame. And he often does this through force, either physical or kind of force of will. He relies on power and strength. I include here the power of logic and reason, which are traditionally masculine in our, you know, way we divide things. The idea that you can argue another person into changing their mind by educating them through superior logic or by mustering a lot of facts. And here, the focus is on changing the other person, changing the people who are wrong. The hero needs to defeat or overcome or change these people, and that means he's got an agenda. So he's heroic to those who agree with his agenda, but he's not to those who don't. Why does this approach appeal to us? I've got some ideas. Well, for one thing, it makes the issue simple. There's a right and a wrong side. If we can just get another people over to the right side, then things will change. The onus is on the hero. We think that if we get the right hero in place, the right person, then we can kind of sit back and wait for that person to solve the problem. And I'm speaking here not just about ourselves, but also what happens when we are the hero, because we take on a tremendous burden when we do that. And I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. So there's this idea that if we just pick the right hero, then the problem will be solved. And I want to talk about what I saw happening after Obama was elected. There was this tremendous uprushing of hope and enthusiasm, and oh boy, you know, now that we've got the right president in place, so many problems will be solved. And then what happened was, of course, that the problems were too big and he had to battle not just one time but continually and to this day against a very recalcitrant Congress, and which isn't, you know, anybody really paying attention knows that. But what I heard from a lot of people was this sense of disappointment that Obama had not solved the problem, that there was something wrong, that he wasn't the person we thought he was. He was, but sometimes the hero just can't do that. I think another reason why the heroic approach appeals to us is that it promises a quick fix. And why that's appealing, there's many reasons why we like a quick fix, but part of it is that it gives us hope. Problems, some of the problems we're facing are huge, and it's hard to have hope sometimes. And if you can think that maybe there's a quick fix to it, then you can continue to hope. Also, I think it expresses an idea that's so deeply embedded in the human psyche that maybe we're not even aware of it, which is that there was a golden time in the past that we could somehow get back to. This idea shows up in most of our religions, most of our myths, and it shows up in our politics. We've got one group that's pretty sure that if we could just get back to how things were in the 1950s, things would be a lot better. We've got another group that thinks if we could get back to the 60s, things would be a lot better. So if you've seen Woody Allen's movie, Midnight in Paris, great movie, it addresses this longing for an imaginary better past that in fact wasn't. Now, those of you who have taken a class from me know that I never can get through anything without bringing up the archetypal psychologist James Hillman, whom I studied with and who had a great influence on my work. Hillman, in his best-selling book, Revisioning Psychology, talks about this desire to return to the examples he gives are the glory that was Greece or Camelot. You know, we love these stories as something very deep in the psyche, but that we need never to take literally. We rather need to understand it as a process of imagination that is getting us in touch with our kind of our instinctive feeling about what an ideal society is like. But we need to stop putting it in the past, and we need to say, how can we work forward to that instead? Some of the problems with the heroic model are, of course, that problems are complex and their roots go deep, and a single act is not going to work. It's a process. Also, if we cling to the idea that a single act or a single person could fix the problem and we don't, then we're going to put blame on that person, as the example I just gave. And if you have been the hero, I think one thing people came up to me and said in the break between the two sessions was that, you know, I've been the hero and I wasn't perfect and I didn't do it all, and I feel so guilty about that. It's a tremendous burden. And another problem is, how often have you actually ever changed another person's mind? I think it's a rare situation when somebody can be reasoned out of a particular stance. What I think changes people's mind is experiences. Experiences that contradict the way they've been thinking. I've got friends who for years said global warming is a hoax, it's not happening. Well, recently they are having experiences and they are starting to go, huh, especially my friends in Texas. But philosophers and psychologists and lately neuroscientists have spent a lot of time in study coming to the conclusion that most of us wear mental filters, filters that we're unaware of, that were really put in place when we were back in a pre-logical, pre-verbal stage by the way we were raised. And what these filters do for us is they prevent us from seeing the things that don't fit with what we believe, unless, like I said, we have an experience that shakes us out of it. But it's hard to give somebody an experience. So what happens is, when someone comes in and says, here's my argument that's completely at odds with your argument, the reaction is usually to think, well, that doesn't make any sense. You must be deluded or stupid. And we see that. If you ever read internet comments under any article on the internet, you're going to see, you know, you're deluded or stupid because you think differently from me. But the problem is that we just are coming from such a different viewpoint. Also, I don't know about you, but I have a contrarian side. And if I find that as soon as someone starts telling me what I should be doing, even if I agree, I tend to kind of get my back up. An extreme example of how that can work is something called the Sahara Club, which got started in reaction to the Sierra Club telling everybody how we needed to take care of the environment. And their purpose is to drive their off-road vehicles out into the wilderness and destroy it. That's what they do. Now, this is an example of how the contrarian impulse can, you know, cause a backlash. It's also an example of what Carl Jung meant when he said that every time we try to shine a bright light in the world, we create a dark shadow. And that, I think, explains some of the vitriol that we're seeing in the current election, because it's actually a fact that we have been making great strides in the realm of human rights. In my lifetime, from when I was a child to now, the living conditions for women, for people of color, for the LGBT community, for the differently abled, it's a totally different world, and it is much, much better. But there's a shadow to that, and it's being voiced by a certain presidential candidate, and there's a lot of rage and hatred directed against people who are different. And I want to tell you that this is a good thing, because the only way to deal with the shadow is to get it out in the open. We, as a culture, all of us, have been party to a lot of racism, sexism, sexual predation, income inequality, exploitation of the world resources. These are not problems that only the bad people have. We have a share in it because we're part of the culture. And right now, the Band-Aids have been ripped off of a lot of really ugly stuff that's always been there in our culture. And as happens when you rip the Band-Aid off a really ugly abscessed wound, there's a lot of pus coming out, and it stinks. But this is the only way it can heal. We have to get it out there. So don't get too upset when you hear some of the stuff, because you just tell yourself, oh, shadow, wow, okay, there it is. You know, let's deal with it now. I mentioned earlier that it's a problem if you feel you are the hero, the one leading the charge, the one who must make it happen, especially if your problem is something huge like global warming, something you can't possibly fix all on your own. I have a good friend who years ago got involved in fighting the biofuel burning at the local mill, and she got way in deep, and she became pretty much a fanatic about it. Every time I saw her, although she knew that I agreed with her, and she knew that I had heard it all before, I got a 2-hour lecture from her on what was going on. She couldn't not talk about it. She couldn't not think about it. She got to the point where she told me she wasn't sleeping, she was upset all the time, she was so tense and she was so angry, and finally she moved away. She couldn't stand to live here anymore. Now, if this has happened or is happening to you or someone you know, I have some advice from you from Marion Woodman, another psychologist. Marion cautions us against making too much of the world sacred. By this, she means that if a person feels personally responsible for something more than they can personally take care of, they're taking on more than they can do, and what they're going to have to do, they're going to feel impelled to do, is to enlist others to their cause, like my friend. Everybody, perhaps, has to get on the cause. They want them to care about it as much as they do. They want them to feel about it as they do. They want them to do what they're doing. So they become proselytizers. And then what happens is that they're inevitably disappointed in other people because they can't get enough people to help. And this can lead to bitterness or disappointment and even perhaps loss of faith in people. How many times have you heard a person who has a cause talk about how awful people are? I've heard it too many times. It's a tragic thing. And what's really scary is that I believe that this is actually one of the causes of terrorism, that people get to the point where they think, I can't get attention, I can't get people to care, there's nothing, I'm so powerless in and of myself, and I have to call attention to my cause some way, and so they blow something up. So don't get me wrong, I love a hero. I think we all love heroes. We put them in our movies, we write lots of stories about them. The media loves to give us an example of someone who's done something really heroic. The hero is an archetype, by which I mean it is an energy that has deep meaning for us. But as with the idea of the Golden Age, we can't take it literally. We can't make a single person into the hero. What I want to suggest that heroism is not just about the right person doing the right thing, but it's also about a way of being. And it's time we started thinking more in those terms. So that leads me back to the way the heroine transforms the community. And I need to say here that I struggled with what to call her in contrast to the hero. If I say the heroic model, then I'm ending up with the heroinic model, which didn't sound right. Heroine in general is a problematic word for me because it's a diminutive of hero, and also people tend to hear heroine in the wrong way. I think I'm talking about some drugs. And anyway, the model is so different from the heroic model that it needs another word altogether. So the image that fits it best for me is that of the midwife. So what's the midwife model of social activism? And I need to tell you that I'm still working this out. This is a new idea that I'm wrestling with. You're getting the debut talk on it. Who knows, there may be another book, but this is the first of that. So, first of all, there's no problem. There's just something new that wants to come into being. Yes, it may be difficult to make that happen. There may be obstacles or troubles associated with that. But there's really no problem. There's just something being born, which is great. The responsibility, then, is to discern what wants to come into being on its own terms. We have to drop our own agendas about what we think should happen. You can't have an agenda about what baby is going to be. We have to drop our own ideas of right and wrong and let go of our idealism in a way. Instead, we have to be kind of pragmatic because there is no right or wrong. It just is. It is, in fact, happening. Like I said, social change is happening. And nothing that you and I do is going to stop it. This is not how it works. One person or several people can't stop the way the culture changes over time. It always happens. But you can facilitate, or you can be a bit of an obstacle. And you have to keep in mind that when you want to change, it's always going to happen slower than you wish. If you don't want it, it's going to happen faster. But it is going to happen. The midwife sees this, and so she works with the energy, not against it. She doesn't use power. She doesn't try to reason with it. You don't reason with a woman in labor. Am I right? You'll get hit. She doesn't force the outcome. She just facilitates as she can and when she can. She's not imposing her own ideas on the situation. She's just aware of what wants to happen, what is coming into being. But she's not doing this instinctively. She is trained. She has gone to school to educate herself. And education to me means that you have opened your mind to things you didn't know before. She has learned skills. So she has changed herself first before she starts working with the energy. She may not be heroic, but she is effective. so she can facilitate the process, but she also knows when to leave it alone. She has the ability to discriminate between when to act and when not. And without even intending it, she can become a role model who others want to emulate, and a ripple effect occurs. As with the story of Zilu that I read you earlier, such a person can help a whole community transform. So in essence, the old paradigm is transformed through a natural process. Nothing has to be forced, no one has to be defeated. People align themselves with the change when and if as they are ready. And if they never are, they are left behind complaining as the community moves forward, and they are to be pitied. So how do you become a midwife of social activism? I have a story about a good friend of mine. She was a high-powered lobbyist. I'm talking, testifying before Congress, meeting with the president. She worked on behalf of children, and she cared deeply about the cause to the point where she was really fueled by anger over the plight of some children. As a result, she could be very abrasive and put people off, although she was all equipped with all these great facts and great arguments. The anger came through and put people off, and it burned her out. Every few years she would burn out, and she would go to her second career. She was a chef, and she'd cook for a year or two to regain her energy. Then she'd go back into the fray, and the cycle would repeat. One time after she'd burned out, she changed things up. She decided to go on a spiritual retreat into the desert for 20 days with some pretty amazing teachers. I picked her up at the airport when she came home, and she was a different person. The anger was gone. Instead, she was operating out of a place of love, out of her heart, and you could feel it. All the force of her convictions were still there. It was just rooted differently. She was calm and sure in her words and actions. She had taken the time out to get to know herself and to find out what it was she personally valued most, how she wanted to be acting in the world. And she was living that. So if this appeals to you, here's what I suggest. First thing, disconnect a bit. Let the shoulds and the musts and the urgency, put it aside for a bit. Go out in nature, breathe deep, relax. Then ask yourself these questions. What matters to me? How do I get in touch with my own integrity, with my own heart? And how do I live and express that in the world? And when you've got some answers about that, come back and then think about the issue that is calling you to activism and ask, how can I shift out of seeing this as a problem and instead see the change that is trying to happen? And how can I personally work with that situation to facilitate that change? And finally, where do I need to have faith? And I'll get back to that. My friend did this. She quit being a lobbyist and instead now works directly with the people she used to advocate for. In other words, she made less of the world sacred. She made enough of it sacred that she could have an effect. And she is effective, and more than that, she's happy. Yes, we still need the heroic approach sometimes. Sometimes you need to do a cesarean. Another example would be that most health problems can be solved by lifestyle changes, but it takes a long time. But if your appendix bursts, you want a surgeon right now. So we need both approaches. We just need to use discrimination about when to use which one. I said I'd get back to the issue of faith. We are in a church, after all. But I'm not talking about faith in a higher power. I'm talking, first of all, about faith in ourselves. Faith that if we do act out of integrity and out of the heart, with respect for others and respect for the energy that is unfolding, we will have a positive effect. I had a conversation with a man between the services who said, you know, I'm not sure. I try to live that way, but I'm not sure if I am. And I said, well, you know, the thing is, you probably will not know most of the effect that you've had. If you are a role model, if you are a kind and compassionate person, there are probably going to be hundreds of people that you touch and influence, and you will never know. So you have to have faith that living this way does affect people. And the second kind of faith you need is that others will be affected. And that they will do the same, that they will say, I want to be like that, and try to do it. And that they don't have to be pushed, they don't have to be argued with. If you just provide an example, you are providing them with that experience of how to do something that may change their minds. And they may, if they're ready, jump on the bandwagon of their own accord. And finally, we need to have faith in the power of even the smallest act to have a huge impact on the world around us. Christ loved to use the example of faith as a mustard seed, saying that if you only had the tiniest amount of faith, you could move mountains. I interpret that, and he was a social activist, we know. So I interpret that to mean that no matter how huge the problem is, no matter how much you may doubt and worry and feel inadequate, if you have even a glimmering of faith in yourself, in others, and in the power of action, it will be enough.